Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I mentioned that I first read Newman as a senior in high school locally here. That experience was an example of that experience I had in this senior English class was an experience that was akin to something that I think Newman appreciates, which I was stressing earlier, and I'll stress even a little bit more on the basis of this sermon on the Feast of St. Monica, which is that Newman wants to, especially in the development of young people and in the university, he wants to bring together in the same person and in the same place things that seem to the wider world to be incongruous or contradictory, like the full flourishing of the life of the mind and the full flourishing of faith. That I was not my parents didn't go to college. There was some question as to whether my mom prayed a lot that I'd go to college, and then when I went, and then when I was 7 years later still in college, she said, "Are you ever going to leave?" But I was not a very serious student. I always thought that if I tried in class, I might actually fail, and that would be embarrassing. And if I succeeded, then people would expect things. So I had very low expectations, and I was also I'm a cradle Catholic, but I was I was a very inconsistent practitioner of the faith in high school. And I got to the University of Maryland after that really big secular, and I was struck by the secular, what then I think was a pretty strident secular. And I had three atheists my first year and a half at Maryland, and that was absolutely the best thing that could have happened to me. It woke me up and made me realize I didn't know what I thought or believed and why, and I needed to figure that out. And actually, at least one of the atheists, who was a philosophy teacher, I stayed in touch with for many years, was a huge help for me in trying to sort that out. But my senior year in high school, I had, as an English teacher, a guy who was the line coach on the football team and the baseball coach, and was also, when DeMatha opened, sort of lower middle class neighborhood in Hyattsville, it was the place in the 1950s that you went to if you got kicked out of public school. So you can imagine the clientele, and this guy was sort of the school bouncer there. But he also, as he was teaching, took the intellectual life seriously and ended up getting a PhD at George Washington in adolescent cognitive development. And a lot of what he taught had to do with that. He was also an agnostic, teaching at a Catholic school. I think I learned actually more theology. This was the 70s. Theology was in pretty bad shape in most Catholic high schools. We read a lot of pop psychology, I'm okay, you're okay, Gaeta. Spent a semester on the Gospel According to Peanuts, which is nice light reading, but that was a religion class. And we read in this English class, even though it was an agnostic, we read poetry that was theological, and we read Newman. And for me, not real serious and not an athlete like a lot of other guys, to have the one of the best coaches be also one of the best teachers brought together things at all boys school, this can make a difference in a 17-year-old male's life. But I got to read Newman with him, and I'm really grateful for that experience. We also read in that class a bunch of short stories, and one of which was a James Joyce short story from Dubliners called Evelyn. And I want to begin with a little bit from that short story as a way into Newman. As the story opens, its main character, Evelyn, who is 19, is sitting in a window overlooking the street in front of her house as evening sets and dust settles all around her in this old house, where she has become a caregiver after the death of her mother. She takes care of two younger siblings and her father, who is both a drunk and physically abusive to her, and the abuse is clearly getting worse. We know from the beginning that she has met a young man, Frank, who says he wants to marry her, take her off to Argentina, and give her the life that she never imagined she could have. I'm going to give away the end of the story here, so sorry about that. Spoiler alert. At the end of the story, she ends up going to the boat on the shore in Dublin to meet him. And in the press of the crowd boarding the boat, they get separated. All the while, she's continuing to feel the pull between the duties and horrors of her current life, the habits she's developed there, and the prospect of this new adventure with Frank. Now, Joyce gives the reader multiple clues that in her imagining of this new life with Frank, she might be really trapped in a lot of naive fantasy, and that we seem to know something as readers that going away to Argentina probably is not going to end up being better than her staying, but she doesn't know this. As Frank boards the boat, she ends up gripping the railing, unable to move. Joyce writes, she clutched the iron railing in frenzy like a helpless animal. As she watches the boat leave, she sent out, this is Joyce again, a cry of anguish and looked at him without love or affection or any emotion whatsoever. Period. End of story. Most of the stories in Joyce's Dubliners, maybe with the exception of the greatest of them all, the last story, The Dead, which was made into a really nice movie, are about characters and the city itself as afflicted by an inability to grow or develop. Hopelessness overcomes all stratas of society. It really doesn't matter whether the characters are single or married, young or old, alcoholic or teetotalers. Dublin gets a hold of every one of them and destroys them. Evelyn is caught between the old and the new, the past or the present and the future. After promising her dying mother that she would help raise her siblings, she is torn between a self-abnegating and deeply demoralizing duty and the happiness that she imagines she can have with Frank. The dust imagery in the opening foreshadows her own fate, weighted down by the past, by what's already dead in her own life and soul. She's 19. Because she has failed to make any changes or expand her imagination or experience in life up to this point, she becomes incapable of moving into any new kind of life. She's stuck in stultifying repetition. Now, Joyce, I think, actually, if we were to read these, I think there's a kind of implicit teleology in these characters that is present by negation. We can see the way in which their lives are frustrated and then work backward from that to imagine what a more flourishing life might be like. But for the characters, again, with the possible exception of the ending of The Dead, their knowledge and the conflicts they experience only exacerbate their condition. They lack even self-knowledge, oblivious of the overarching story of Dublin that shapes and in a sense truncates their lives. Articulating the story or stories that have shaped our lives is a prerequisite for self-knowledge and for moral action. There's a great line, my favorite line, from The Lord of the Rings. Sam and Frodo are enjoying a quiet moment on their trek toward Mordor when Sam talks about the brave things in the old tales and songs, adventures, as I used to call them, Mr. Frodo. I used to think that they were things the wonderful folk of the stories went out and looked for because they wanted them, because they were exciting and life was a bit dull, a kind of sport, as you might say. But that's not the way of it with the tales that really mattered or the ones that stay in the mind. Folks seem to have been just landed in them, usually. Their paths were laid that way. I wonder what sort of tale we've fallen into. I love that line, what sort of tale we've fallen into. A counter to the recruitment pitch of nearly every major university, come here and you can write your own story. You don't write, you have a role to play and you have some writing to do, but you first got to discover the stories that you're already part of. And the great quest stories are not just about these sorts of conflicts. You know, he goes on to say there that there's a difference between the kind of stories that we like to read about in the Shire, which are full of risk and fighting and death and the kind of story you want to be in. And then he says, Mr. Frodo, I fear we're in one of those stories that we would prefer to be back in the Shire reading about. Quest stories about the moments when individuals find them in one story that opens up into a higher and more demanding story, or just a different path. In Lewis's great fantasy series, children go through the wardrobe and into a cosmic battle between good and evil. So too with Tolkien. When the hobbits leave the Shire, they not only have to give up second and third breakfast and whatever it is that they're smoking back in those pipes in the Shire, but they're also called to fulfill arduous tasks to save Middle-earth. In less momentous, sometimes equally momentous, each of us wonders at various points in our lives what sort of story we've fallen into. One of the most important tasks for us, and this is especially important at your age, but it's important for all of us at every stage, is to determine and examine again freshly what stories are we part of? How have we been formed? Coming to know formative stories does not in itself determine how we ought to behave now or what course our future lives should take. We will need to reflect on our role within them and how we ought to respond. Some stories, or at least parts of them, may need to be discarded or repudiated or significantly revised. And it's likely that we have all inherited conflicting stories. Sometimes your parents have given you Mom and dad have given you conflicting stories, or members of your family have given you conflicting stories. About the role of money and career advancement, about standards of success, about friendship, family, and religious calling. We confront conflicts between conventional accounts of success and a deeper sense of calling, between aspirations for marriage, family, and children on the one hand, and growth in other ways in our lives on the other. To lead an integrated life, we first have to acknowledge, reckon with, and in many circumstances simply endure the conflicts between the various stories that have shaped us. One of the psychologists that I read with, not a big fan of a lot of psychology, but one of the psychologists that I read with, this teacher I had in high school, was Eric Erickson, who works on these conflict and identity. There's actually really beautiful interpretation that he gives of Ingmar Bergman's, I think his most beautiful film, Wild Strawberries, which is about an older man who's getting an award and ends up going traveling back in his memory to his childhood and ends up leading from a life of elderly despair facing death to something like integrated wisdom and gratitude. And lots of these stories can be read according to Erickson's stages of development. He describes these in terms of key conflicts at various periods in life. The question is whether those conflicts are resolved or not, and how. For the period of adolescence, Erickson sees the key conflict between the formation of a coherent identity on the one hand and remaining in confusion on the other. The failure to develop that all over our society right now is a huge source of mental health affliction. It's both effect and cause of a lot of the loneliness that we see in our culture. For the elderly, he sees a potential tension between an integrated sense of one's own life on the one hand and despair on the other. Wisdom comes with age and integration, and this I think is really borne out in that Bergman film, Wild Strawberries. On this view and that of a contemporary philosopher who was heavily influenced by Newman, Alistair MacIntyre, conflicts are unavoidable. We can be grateful if the conflicts that we experience come at the right time. That is, at a point where we have the resources to confront and sort them out. The difficulty is that you can't plan for them to come at the right time. Initially, they always seem to have come at the wrong time. When I did, for almost two decades, recruitment events of honor students at Baylor, and one of the things we would feature is a faculty panel, and all these really bright kids would be asking, they'd all have their hand up at the same time. They're all little Hermiones from Harry Potter. It doesn't matter what gender they were all little Hermiones. And they're all asking a version of the question, if I come here, how can I be sure that I'll succeed? And they're getting various sorts of advice. And after a while, I would wait and then interrupt and say, you know, one of the things that's going to happen to you next year, if you're here or elsewhere, is you're going to fail at something. And what you're going to have to do is to fail and then recover from it. Some unanticipated crisis, it might be in their social life. It certainly could be academic. Might be with a roommate, might be a romantic relationship, or maybe it'll involve painfully unwelcome and surprising news from home. Whatever it might be, I'd say you're going to have to fail and recover from it. And as I said this, I could physically witness their little minds, their little overachieving minds working, kicking in the gear, thinking, okay, on October 12th this fall, I will fail, and by the 14th, I will have it figured out. But of course, that's not how the challenging conflicts and failures come at us. They arrive unanticipated and hit us like a truck. And then we have to figure out whether we have the resources to respond. The conflicts that come at the right time, which can only be known after the fact that it was the right time, are those that enable us to discover, as we with fear and trembling try to meet them, that we have some resources, maybe in our own history, maybe in the stories that we've been part of, but haven't yet articulated for ourselves. These resources may be latent within our souls because of the kind of formation we've had intellectually, morally, and spiritually. We may discover that family members or friends can be sources of resiliency and wisdom, as can professors, counselors, pastors. We might discover that in our very midst, there are examples of courage, generosity, patience, and other virtues that we now no longer see as optional, but as necessary for our survival and flourishing as we face a particular challenge. I think in this context, Newman's own account of cognitive development, which I sketched a little bit of in the earlier lecture, can be helpful. It runs through many of his works, but I think it's found especially in the idea of a university. I think it's also there in the development of doctrine. These are parallel teachings that Newman is articulating. Newman presents us with a model of university education that sees its primary aim, as I said earlier, as the pursuit of knowledge for its own sake in its complexity and its unity. I mentioned this briefly earlier. I want to spell this out a little bit more now. It's important to see that for education and for our own cognitive development, it's possible to go wrong in two directions. There can be too much complexity, the result of which is disintegration, where nothing fits together. That is the chief vice of much of modern education, where the splintering of knowledge into highly specialized subfields within a vast array of discipline leaves students with no ability or even the hope of connecting the various parts of what they know. When I was dean at Baylor in the Honors College, one of the things I thought that we needed to do there, and we had a great text program and integrated core that our students took, but I would describe one of the things we were doing is to help students articulate the questions that fall between the cracks in the disciplines. Back especially 20-some years ago when I was first at Baylor, I had never heard the phrase young earth before going to Baylor. I'd heard young life, but I'd never heard the phrase young earth. That's my own ignorance, right? But so students were, some students, bright students, coming out of quasi-fundamentalist backgrounds, which had in some ways done them a lot of good, but in other ways were not helpful. They go to their science classes where all they got was straight reductionist biology, unless you had a teacher who went into some of these other things. But there were, if you're in a place like that, the science people are really worried about the encroachment of religion and philosophy onto. The funny thing for me was that I discovered in my first semester as a dean there that I could use Newman's language, and the Baptists who were worried about fundamentalism encroaching upon science, it was acceptable to them because Newman has a sense of the complexity, as does Aquinas, the limited autonomy of each of the disciplines. Like, well, this is okay. But the students coming in with Very literal readings. I'd like to give them Augustine's De Genesi ad literam for a literal reading of Scripture, where the 6 days of creation are six visions that God gives to the angels, and that, Augustine says, is the literal reading. That would blow their minds, and the science faculty minds. But I thought we had to be a place where students could come and ask intellectual questions about how you put together your belief in God as creator and the special creation of humankind with the sciences. Because otherwise what you're doing is you're creating people of faith who are intellectual schizophrenics and who are just, you're just setting them up for failure when they get out into the real world. I think this is what partly what Newman means by the philosophical habit, right? It's connecting these things that whether the disciplines connect them or not, your mind naturally wants to say, ooh, what does this have to do with that? And if you've got elements of education that are suppressing asking that question or making you fearful of asking that question, you're going to end up with a truncated intellectual development and a faith that's really vulnerable. Okay, so one problem is lack of integration. That's the main problem with modern education. But it's also possible to go wrong by having integration come too quickly. If it comes prematurely, as it does for individuals and communities that think they know everything there is to know and thus close off further inquiry, then the quest for knowledge is short-circuited. Dante is asking questions in the second to last canto in Paradise. He is still asking questions there. Questions are natural to the human mind at every stage. And if that gets short-circuited, then development can no longer happen. Further expansion will not be possible or will occur only within a very narrow range of inquiry. That's an academic or philosophical way of putting it. But as we've seen from Joyce's Evelyn, such truncating of development can and does occur in the stories of individual and communal lives. Evelyn's development beyond the narrow confines of the world of her family is impossible. What's most horrifying about her story is that all her options have been foreclosed at the age of 19. Here's a passage from Newman's Idea that explicitly develops a robust view of human inquiry. And here we go with one of these long sentences. We know not by a direct and simple vision, not at a glance, but as it were by piecemeal and accumulation, by a mental process, by going around an object, by the comparison, the combination, the mutual correction of many partial notions. Period. Such a union and concert of the intellectual powers, such an enlargement and development, such comprehensiveness is necessarily a matter of training. Newman thinks that our minds, whether we are confronting high-level philosophical or scientific questions, or questions that arise in our ordinary experience of the world, reach out for enlargement and comprehensiveness. By the way, I think I might have mentioned this earlier in passing, but this is one of the correctives in Newman to the gentleman's turning everything in upon himself, right? If the healthy operation of the mind is always to be wanting to learn more, to have wonder even about positions that you don't understand or that are not necessarily in full agreement with yours, then the gentleman should not be as happy and content with his current level of knowledge than he appears to be. So the natural curiosity of children, which thrives until parents or school systems thwart it, is an indication of the natural impulse or thrust of the human intellect to ask questions and be capacious and expansive. If the mind is naturally expansive, it is not, for Newman, merely passively receptive as it takes in more information and knowledge. It has to be actively engaging with what it receives. We have to make, Newman says, this knowledge our own. I love this sentence. We have to make the objects of knowledge subjectively our own and digest what we receive into the substance of our previous state of thought. What he is describing here is something that goes beyond academia. It's a task for us in our lives throughout our entire lives. What he says this is living organic knowledge. And this is beautiful. It gives us a connected view of the old and the new, the past and the present, far and near. It gives us insights into the influence of all of these on one another. Without this subjective digestion, Newman says, there is no whole and no center to your thinking or your life. Of course, the center itself will not remain the same over time. It will move as we have new experiences and take on new knowledge. There's a great line in Henry James's, the novelist book, The Art of Fiction, where he says, if you want to be a great fiction writer, try to be someone on whom nothing is lost, so that you're aware of everything that you're experiencing and learning, and you're making it part of who you are, how you talk about the world, how you talk about your life, and if you're a fiction writer, how you write. That's a lot better than saying just write what you know, which is also true, because you really can't write anything else. If I were to suggest, I already did, one reading from Newman, I'd like to urge you to read the sermon, Intellect, Instrument of Religious Training, that he delivered on the Feast of St. Monica during a Mass to celebrate the beginning of the academic year at the New University in Dublin. Newman sees in Monica's relationship to Augustine an analogy for the relationship that the church has to the minds of young persons. Newman says, the purpose of a Catholic university is to reunite things that were in the beginning joined together by God, but which have been put asunder by man. The chief separation is between faith and knowledge, since the modern assumption is to be religious, you must be ignorant, and to be intellectual, you must be unbelieving. Newman's corrective is to insist that the religious and the intellectual should be found in one and the same place, exemplified in the same persons. The intellect must range freely, and faith must be developed explicitly and robustly. Newman notes that in early youth, the various powers of the soul operate in relative unity. With the development of both desire and reason, the powers of the adolescent soul seek out different avenues for their exercise. Some are drawn to and pursue passion or appetite. Others brute strength and material resources. Still others, the reign of virtue or that of intellect. He concludes this reflection by noting, because some men follow duty, others pleasure, others glory, and others the intellectual life, young people think, therefore, that to be one of these things excludes the other, that duty cannot be pleasant, that virtue cannot be intellectual, that goodness cannot be great, that conscientiousness cannot be heroic. Notice that virtue cannot be intellectual line is a further chapter after what we talked about earlier, where the academic life in itself is not properly about the formation of moral virtue. But Newman's very worried about the community in which students are studying, that they not be presented with people where the intellectuals are amoral and the virtuous people are happily not all that smart. If these conflicts are not resolved, then over time, the division will go away one way or another, because the soul cannot stand this kind of division for long. So one or another of the dominant passion or aspirations will take over and create what Newman calls a mini kingdom, it's beautiful, in the soul of the young person. The result is that young people begin to lose the delight they once had in going home. They can no longer return to that unity that they had. It's a bit of romanticism here, but Newman's response is not romantic. It's not simply to go back to childhood. It's something of an irony for Newman that in an ordinary university, even one, as I argued in the first paper, that accepts Newman's model of education, the likely result is precisely this discord or idolatry in the soul. That's why Newman thinks that we need to counter or balance the university with what is proper to a college, and especially a religious college, which I talked about earlier. Newman highlights the indispensable role of what he calls in another sermon, personal influence. I want to say one thing before I talk about this sermon, which is about Philip Neri. And Philip Neri comes up, if you've read The Idea of a University, you know that he spends all these chapters endlessly defending knowledge for its own sake. Warns us a little about the gentleman, but the book still returns in the end to knowledge as desirable for its own sake. But then in the concluding chapter, he turns to Philip Neri, who was not an intellectual, as a model for the Christian life. And Neri fits, he says that Neri establishes a home of Christian mirth. It's really a beautiful line. That what Neri practiced were the arts of Christian, how I would put it, the arts of Christian hospitality. And this was so disarming that he won over people who were initially very opposed to the faith. But that Newman ends The Idea of a University by turning to Neri, I think underscores what I was suggesting earlier, that Newman is aware that liberal education, even on the model he proposes, has some serious dangers from the perspective of the faith. And in this sermon, Newman starts out by talking about the difficulties of persuading opponents of the faith, particularly through argument. One, he says, has to do with the advantage critics have in picking at individual claims that may be distant from the core, appear unfounded, and whose defense would require establishing a complicated framework. You've been in conversations like this, right, where somebody just picks at this, and then once you start to respond to that, they pick at something else, right? They jump around. Trying to pin people down by argument is really, can be really difficult. The other has to do with malevolent intentions. Although some people may verbally praise virtue, they harbor at the bottom of their hearts an evil feeling that to be bound to certain laws and principles is a superstition and a slavery, and that freedom consists in the actual exercise of the will in evil as well as good. The best means of persuasion, he says, is personal influence. This is a pretty amazing line. Truth is upheld in the world, not as a system, not by books, not by argument, not by temporal power, but by the personal influence of those who in the areas of virtue and holiness are both teachers and patterns of it. That's another way to correct the worry that Newman and Aristotle have about taking refuge in theory, right? If the teacher is to some extent, and I would say even if the teacher is making the students aware at every moment of what it would mean not just to understand the theory, but to pattern it, right? But the ideal for Newman is to actually have some teachers who are articulate and embody the virtues in their own lives for long periods of time inside and outside the classroom with students at both what we would call the high school and the college level. Nothing, he writes, is more effectual first in irritating, then in humbling the pride of men. I've seen examples of this. Great sort of skeptical Straussian political philosopher, Stanley Rosen, one of the greatest, one of Strauss's greatest students. He was pretty anti-religious, and he was at Boston University, and was on a thesis defense. We went out to lunch afterward, and he had been at Chicago for a while and had known, I think, a Jesuit priest there. He had also known Yves Simon very well, whom he admired for the great student of Maritain, whom I think was actually a better philosopher than Maritain. But he admired in him, and then particularly in this priest, this combination of intellectual range and confidence in the intellectual life, no fearfulness, sort of joy in it, not a defensiveness, along with what he took to be a remarkably happy, sacrificial life. He got to know these folks well enough. And he was, he said at lunch, simply astonished by that. He just didn't know what to make of it. And that, for me, has always been a kind of example of what Newman is talking about here. It's striking to me how diverse and unified Newman's own writings are. They're different accents in different works, but the same underlying themes surface. And he addresses them in richly complimentary way. At one point, Newman articulates the following set of propositions. First, truth cannot be contrary to truth, since all truth comes from God. The God who reveals himself in Scripture is the same God who created this vast universe and each of our simultaneously powerful and puny intellects. There can thus ultimately be no conflict in what is taught in these various modes by this one God who is truth himself. Nonetheless, second, it often seems that truth contradicts truth. Newman's advice, third, is that we should face the experience of such seeming contradictions in patience and hope, not with anxiety and defensiveness, in seeking and in remaining faithful. There's a wonderful line in Aquinas, in the Summa, in which he ponders what we are to make of seemingly rational objections to the faith. Since, anticipating Newman here, truth cannot ultimately contradict truth, whatever seemingly valid objections emerge from natural reason, we know, he says, it is possible to answer them. I love both the confidence and the humility in that sentence. It is possible. He isn't saying that we can all immediately figure out the answer. He isn't even saying that he can figure out all the answers, and he figured out a lot of them. He's saying that we know in principle, that these are resolvable. In the face of such difficulties and tensions, we should be patient and keep working at these issues, learning from those who are wise, so that over time we can allow resolutions and we can also allow integration to emerge in God's time. The counsel is relevant more broadly, I think, and this is my ending, to the various tensions and conflicts we experience in our lives. Sometimes, some periods, some seasons in life, as we are expanding our experience and knowledge, we have moments of great adventure and growth and joy. Integration comes easily, or at least the quest for it is characterized by hope and by joy. At other times, we don't seem to be moving much at all, or we seem to be growing and expanding, but not integrating. We're stretched too thin. Then there are times when we're tempted to despair over whether expansion or integration is at all possible, where things seem, where our lives seem fragmentary, and where we're troubled by doubts and fears. We can experience and will experience what Dorothy Day calls in the title of her autobiography, the long loneliness. Even when in the midst of good friends and family, we can and will be lonely. For all of his optimism about growth, development, expansion, and integration, Newman himself endured many periods of loneliness and desolation. In his 30s, while traveling in Sicily amid a crisis of calling, he suffered a serious illness. After his travel was significantly delayed, he set off on a boat from Sicily and composed a poem or hymn that I want to end with. Lead, kindly light, amid the encircling gloom. Lead thou me on. The night is dark, and I am far from home. Lead thou me on. Keep thou my feet. I do not ask to see the distant scene. One step enough for me. I was not ever thus, nor prayed that thou shouldst lead me on. I love to choose and see my path, but now lead thou me on. I loved the garish day, and spite of fears, pride ruled my will. Remember not past years. So long thy power hath blessed me, sure it still will lead me on, o'er moor and fen, o'er crag and torrent, till the night is gone. And with the morn, those angels' faces smile, which I have loved long since and lost a while. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.